with God, is consciousness of self. So now we no longer have this, this is no longer just a sensory brain. And always try to keep in mind that when talking about, whenever I'm using a circle, this mind is constantly bending on itself. And I call this, which is the knowing self. Now, consciousness consists of two different dimensions of experience. And one dimension alone, which I'm going to talk about first, is the knowing self. Now, on an unconscious level, an unconscious, I mean, you're not normally aware of it, this mind is always bending on itself. And the what consciousness really is more than anything else is the act of bending. Consciousness is a dynamic thing. It isn't just staring at ourselves. It's the very act of the mind bending on itself, which is the kind of the essence or the, in other words, consciousness is an act. It's not just a thing. It's a dynamic act. And in this act, the mind bends on itself. And in bending on itself, knows itself. And here we get the term self. Here we look at where we're. But on the unconscious level, it is constantly bending on itself, which is why I call it reflexive. This is an autonomous mechanism. It's not under our control. We did not choose to be human. This is what it means to be human, is to have an or be really reflexive consciousness. And so, like a muscle, you know, it is a reflexive mechanism. And that, and I really want to stress the word reflex, because that is the nature of the unconscious level. Now, when we talk about the conscious level, or when we are aware of our own self-awareness, when we become aware, you might say, of this reflexive being that we are, then we come to the conscious level of consciousness, and I call that the reflective level of consciousness. And we do have some control over this reflective level. We can choose to look inward, look at ourselves, kind of a self-examination, or we can choose not to. And but on an unconscious level, we don't have that choice. The mind is always bending on itself. Now, this is very important to understand, because in many of these meditative techniques, in the meditative techniques that we hear about, quieting the mind, and many people claim that they're no longer aware of themselves and so on, that we can actually, with practice, have some control over this reflective level. We can become so silent and in a way no longer really looking at ourselves. That, however, the reflexive level of consciousness is going right on. So later on we will talk about this experience and reality that we call ecstasy. But for right now, I just want to get across that consciousness is composed of two different, of the knowing self, has two different levels. One is the unconscious level and one is the conscious level. But altogether, I just call it consciousness. And altogether, I just call it self. So we're aware of ourselves all the time, whether we're aware of it or not. We are aware of ourselves. And it doesn't matter. It also, as we can see, because of this reflexive mechanism, consciousness is dual. The knowing self, anyway, is a dual system. Because the way we know ourselves is an object to ourselves. And it doesn't matter which side we say is the subjective side, because they're identical. The subject is the object here. We often hear this idea that the subject is the object, but this only refers to consciousness, to self. The primary object of consciousness is always itself. The primary object of self is always self. So it doesn't matter whether we call it subject or object. Many people make a mistake. They mistake what we might call a sensory object, like a stone or a table. And then they say, well, here I'm the subject and that's the object. But they're not identical. This is a mistake. They're not identical. What is identical, however, is the subject and object of consciousness. They are the same thing. And that's the first thing we see, is this subject and object of consciousness. So the object is just the subjective, is the objective. This is just the objective self and the subjective self. How have I put that in the past? This is just the subject objectified, you might say. Some woman, when I was going over this demonstration, she said she was a biologist and zoologist, and she said she really understood this, had a feeling for this reflexive mechanism, and she kind of made the gesture this way, you see. And her idea was that what this mechanism is, and I don't know on a biological level what it is, that it's the exchange, that it's one side of the brain knowing and seeing each other, seeing one another. It's the exchange between the two. You see, now I don't know how that works, but somehow it made sense to her. And as I say, I'm not interested in the biological aspect of it, except that this knowing self, and the fact it is dualistic, is simply our experience. Nothing is more immediate, you know, than, hey, you know, what am I or who am I? Well, I'm myself. But consciousness has a different dimension, a second dimension. And that is the energy and what we would call the center of consciousness. And that other dimension is what we call the feeling dimension. So consciousness consists of a feeling dimension, which is located basically at the center of consciousness. And then it has a knowing dimension. And between this knowing and feeling, we really, it encompasses the totality of all our human experiences. And we're going to go into that. Now, in order for this mechanism to run, you might say, to keep this little machine going, if we can put it that way, you need some fuel. You need a specific energy. And this energy is that other dimension of consciousness, the feeling self. And it seems to be located not up here in our minds, but if you could silence the mind, somehow we're carried down to an energy center. I just call it below the neck. I think Carl Jung was right. This little dot in the center of the circle, by the way, is what I refer to as the center of consciousness. And I think Carl Jung was right when he located or suggested that the center of consciousness was equivalent to the body's center of gravity, which means that depending on our bodily build, maybe, each person may experience a little different center of himself or center of gravity. The reason why I agree with Jung on this fact, because if there were no self, you see, there is like a release from gravity, and there becomes the experience of such lightness, you know, like floating. One feels that they're floating. There's also a sense of bodilessness without this center of gravity, which is equally the center of consciousness. So whether people want to locate it in their heart, which strikes me as more a place for the sentiments, some people locate it more towards the navel. And one time, some years ago, I picked up a book called Hara by a German philosopher by the name of von Durkheim. I believe that was his name. And he had been to Japan and picked up on their term Hara. I'm not too sure what the Japanese mean by that term, but it's a gut level experience, And but from what he said about it in his book, I instantly knew this, instantly recognized it through my own experience as really being the center of consciousness. So let us talk about some of those experiences for which this center is responsible. First of all, it is an energy center, and it is that energy that's going to run or propel the reflexive mechanism of the mind. And it is an energy that is specific to consciousness. In other words, it's not the energy that runs the senses. It's not the energy, whatever energy it is, that runs our biological system, or the cellular or subatomic system. It's not that energy. This energy we're talking about, or this other dimension, second dimension of consciousness, is specific to consciousness. So that if you were to be without self or without consciousness, this energy would disappear. But the energy remains for the body, the senses, and life goes on, just put it that way. But we don't know that. So long as we are living self, consciousness, so long as we are that, we do not realize that. For many, this center of energy seems to be, we experience it as the center of life. It is a life force. We experience that center as life, as being, as existence. That is located right here. Even if, you know, I would say if you could even stop your mind, it will be there. And it's a subtle experience, and this is probably one of the first things that we do in the spiritual life is make contact. In silencing ourselves, we will contact this center of our being, and we're going to talk more about that. So this center, the experience of this center is the experience of life, of being. Being is much more of a silent experience. Life is more dynamic. But the center of consciousness is all this. And it is experience we don't realize it until afterwards, but it's the experience of having a soul, of being a soul. It is also the experience of being a bodily entity. We don't usually realize that. Now, up one from there is the experience of willpower, of will, volition. It's a powerhouse. The center of consciousness is a powerhouse. And up from there, up from will, we get into the whole affective system. All those feelings, love and hate, fear, anxiety, what joy, whatever it is. And up from there, we have all these very subtle experiences of various sentiments. You know, pity and compassion, gentleness. And we have also some experiences we don't even equate with consciousness or self. And that, like being tired, being bored, a sense of serenity, calmness, all of this is due to that center of consciousness. This is the feeling self, the experiential self. And this, as we said, reflecting this fuel, you might say, also causes the reflexive mechanism of the mind. Now, I don't find anything particularly mysterious here about this reflexive mechanism, but there is definitely something very mysterious about that center of consciousness and all that that means. But put these two together, the knowing self and the experiencing self, and we have the totality of the purely human experience. Sure, we can still taste and we can still hear, which is the senses, but that's not what's unique about us. As we know, who was it, Helen Keller, all she could do, I guess, was touch. But what a magnificent mind she had, full consciousness. She really taught us something. That with the minimalist, even despite the minimal use of the senses, consciousness is so superior to it. At the same time, it may come as a surprise to some people that man can actually live without consciousness because of the senses, you see. But neither man nor animal can live without the senses. So now, also one more point, a very important point I have to make, is that you see this pinhole that I've said is the center of consciousness. If you put this, if I put this to my eye here, I can actually look through it. And it's, which means that consciousness is open-ended. It has an openness in itself. And if we could look through this hole in ourselves, if we could look down into the deepest point of our being, and that deepest point of our being is the center of consciousness. If we could look down into it, do you know we might find this little peephole and be able to look through it. And what would we see if we looked through that peephole? In this creative act of God, God having created consciousness, he knew that man could not see. We say that God is everywhere, but man can't see everywhere. He can't see it with his senses, and he can't see it with consciousness. So what, in order to be able to see God, you might say, be aware of God, God, as it were, covered up everything, covered up himself. This is just a way of putting it. It's not the reality. But it's like consciousness. Say that everything out here is God. But we're, consciousness is like a veil over God that he puts in front of him and leaves only a little peephole in the center. So that now, looking deep into ourselves, or later looking out, we can actually focus on God. You see, if God's everywhere, we can't focus on God. You know, the idea, many people, when you're approaching about religion, they always say, well, God's everywhere, so I don't have to go to church, I don't need religion, God's everywhere. So it's a cliche, because they don't really see God everywhere. If you ask them, well, what do they see when they see God everywhere? Well, they'll start stuttering around, and usually it comes down to some mundane thing, like when you give some money to a beggar. Well, I certainly think that that's a manifestation of man's goodness and of God, but you're really not seeing God. And above all, you're not seeing him everywhere, because that's just a very specific incident of how man can manifest God in his life. But to really see God, to be able to focus on God, you see, God consciousness can do this because of this center. We can look through this center. It's like looking through a microscope or a telescope. The sky is so vast, we can't take it all in. But if with our telescope, we can focus in, you see, and now we see the marvel of it. Now we don't mistake one thing for another. Now we can focus on God. So this little peephole in the center of consciousness, if we look, we will find God there. And if we could look out through the peephole, then we can begin to see how God is everywhere. It's like an hourglass. You have a tiny hole by which you spot God. And if you could see out there, then it becomes vast. So that's how man really sees God. It's not by looking all around. We can look and look and look. And God is everywhere, but we're not going to see him. So this people is going to be man's particular way of seeing God, knowing God. And as we'll see, of God's knowing us and contacting us. So that also lies underneath, you might say, the center of consciousness. Now, so far I've only used this side of the card, but now I want to turn it around. And you'll see I have made a circle around this peephole. And what this circle is what I call the ego. That within this whole little center here is what I call the ego center. And this is man's, what you might say, original consciousness. Now, it means that all of consciousness is centered around ourself. So the ego then is being for itself. It's wanting our own will. It's pursuing our own good. It is our own self-enhancement. And obviously, it is it's the totality of consciousness. It isn't just some little ego. Many people think that that there's all of consciousness and then there's the ego. But you see, this is our original consciousness. And even though later on we'll look back and say that this was an immature consciousness, and to some extent it is, nevertheless, this is how things are to begin with. It is the first real or deepest self that we encounter. Now, many people, many people have the wrong idea about the ego self. Many people refer to it as the false self, but there's nothing false about it. It is real, and it is important. It's our dynamic energy center. The ego is that in man which goes in pursuit of God, his highest good. The ego is the state of the freest will that we'll ever have. But I want to say something about this misnomer that people have, that the ego is bad or that it is false. Let us say what we mean by false self. And I'm going to take this from examples in my own life. Starting at about the age of 3, I began to fight my mother just to be able to be myself. She was always saying to me, for example, "Now I want you to be a nice girl. If you're not good, nobody's gonna like you. I want you to be this way, or you ought to be that way." And I used to say, "Hey, how can I be anybody but myself? I'm just myself. What she wanted me to be was she wanted to make me over into her own image and likeness. And I used to say to her, who do you want me to be? Shirley Temple." So my mother and I, starting at the age of 3, we went at it. Finally, when I was about 7 or 8, she gave up because I was determined simply to be myself. Now, looking back, I can see how people, this can take on a false self by trying to be what other people think they should be, by allowing other people to mold you according to their image of you. Why, you're trying to, they have an image of you and you're trying to live up to it. And in doing that, you try to please others and you're not being true to yourself. So this is what we mean by the false self. It means taking on other people's images of you and not having, looking deep into yourself and having your own image of yourself, which means in a way having no image of ourselves. Because we are just ourselves. So the ego in itself is strong, and it is that which says, "Hey, I am myself." The ego, remember, is deep in the center of ourselves. This isn't some peripheral little false image of ourselves. This is our true self. It's this, the ego gives man, it's responsible for man's sense of his worth, his being unique, individual, distinct, having a mind of his own, a being of his own. It means standing tall, accepting responsibility. It means striving to be good. All this, that's what the ego is. And it is, basically, it is good. Now, if there's any problem with the ego, is that it can go either way. It has free will. It can either go in pursuit of the highest good, or it can go in pursuit of what is less than good. And when I say go in pursuit of good, I mean good for itself. And let's face it, nothing's better for us than God. Nothing's better for us than goodness and all those virtues. And who's going and seeking? Who's going in pursuit of that? Where's all that energy coming from? That is the ego. So the ego is the powerhouse for goodness. The problem is, it can also go the other way. It can become a powerhouse for downright evil. I cannot think of any evil in the world for which man is not responsible. And so this ego and all this energy here is responsible for both the greatest good in the world and for the greatest evil in the world. So the problem with the ego is that it is not stable, because it can go either way. Today we may want to be good and go in pursuit, and maybe this pursuit of goodness will last a few weeks, a month, a year, and then there's a reverse. So the ego is just not that stable. And if we're going to transcend the ego, it isn't because it is bad, but because it is not stable in goodness. Many people think they know what the ego is, but the ego, like all self-consciousness, is only known when it's gone. It's known in retrospect. And so all our ideas about the ego are probably, most of them are false. It's only when that ego falls away that we really know what that ego is. And it's why I say that it is being primarily for itself. It is not being for God. It is being for itself. And in fact, the reason why we go in search of God is, frankly, for ourselves, for our own good. And we can say, well, is that a self-centered, you know, egotistical thing to do? Yeah, but it's the best thing that we can do, is that, you know, is to go in pursuit for our own sake, first of all, because we cannot help others unless we are first help ourselves. And so it really starts with ourselves, and we pursue God for our own good, not for somebody else's good. And that's what the ego does. That's its function. So the totality of consciousness, then, is what we can call egoic consciousness. And this is our original consciousness. And as I always experienced it, God, you know, I realized the center of myself. And I always saw that God was, as it were, below it. And so one of the paradoxes, you might say, of the journey is that to get out, ultimately, to get out of self, we have to go through self. And that means we go inward. So it's rather a paradox to say that we go out of self by going inward, because we go outward by making the journey through self.